now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Logan, everybody, this is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our guest is Robert Phoenix. Robert has been a guest on our show before. I've been a guest on Robert's show. We've got a lot to discuss. I'm really looking forward to this discussion. So without any further ado, Robert, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
James, always great to be here. My San Jose brother, my Oakland A brother. Mm-hmm. Yep, we got the Bay. We got the born. I wasn't born by the Bay, but I grew up by the Bay.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I often think about those days, the innocence. You know, I was still kind of a hot-headed young man and had my core beliefs. And over time, a lot of my core beliefs have had to undergo somewhat radical adjustment over time to kind of accommodate ongoing trends and current events, what have you. You know, the floor is yours, buddy. It's what's on your mind. I mean, there's so much going on today. One more day over there. It's the anniversary of September 11th, 2001. Where are we?
I just did a 2-hour show. I think I stopped about a half an hour before we were supposed to meet here. So I just burned for like 2+ hours on this whole 9/11 thing. So a lot of the material is still, you know, fresh in my head, and I have a lot of material available, but we could talk about some of that. There are things that I did not talk about on that show that we could certainly go over that I think are, I think, meaningful. So we could just go down the 9/11 rabbit hole if you want to. As you can see here that I've got this graphic, right? And all these characters are there for a reason. And one of the things that I really kind of dropped into a rabbit hole with 9/11 was the symbolism around the astrological sign of Gemini, because we're dealing with the twin towers, right? The twins. And there's a lot more than just the twin towers. All the people here in this photo right here that you can see, theoretically, they're all Geminis with the exception of George Bush Jr., which is W, which is, he's going to be down there in the corner, right? So there's old man Bush, and then we got Prince over there, Larry Silverstein. And then there's Trump and Giuliani. I gave them the Rosie Grier, Ray Milland effect there. You see that? Do you remember that movie, the thing with two heads? You ever see that movie?
No, I didn't.
So it was a crazy movie back in the 60s, one of those kind of schlock Roger Corman films. And it was the thing with two heads, and it was the football player Rosie Grier, right? And Ray Milland, who at this point in time was really way past his prime. And they're like this science experiment where, you know, they stick Ray Milland's head on Rosie Grier's body. It's really one of the most bizarre movies around. But there's some interesting connections. You know, Rosie Grier was with Bobby Kennedy when Bobby Kennedy was killed. A lot of people don't think Bobby Kennedy was killed. I do, by the way. I'm on the record with that. Another kind of twin thing, Bobby Darin was there too. So you had two Bobbies. Bobby Darin's a weird guy, by the way. There's a lot of strange stuff around Bobby Darin. I don't know if you... Are you familiar with Bobby Darin at all?
I've always liked him as a singer and entertainer. I was kind of disturbed later when Kevin Spacey did the biopic about him. But I've always liked his music. Darin, fill me in about Bobby Darin. I'm not aware of... I know that he had a kind of, health issue-ridden life.
So he's one of these guys. He's from the East Coast. And he's one of these guys that doesn't have like a traceable father. And you'll find that a lot of stars in Hollywood don't have traceable fathers, and athletes too. Like Shaquille O'Neal does not really have a traceable father, although he claims he had contact with him, but I don't think we've ever really seen Shaq's real father. Draymond Green does not have a traceable father. LeBron James does not have a traceable father. It's a kind of a theme you'll see with certain people. And Jack Nicholson does not have a traceable father. In fact, Jack Nicholson, for the longest time, thought his grandparents were his parents. And his older sister, whom he moved to Los Angeles with, was actually his mother. Terrell Owens has another weird thing with it. The Terrell Owens thing is really weird. So his father lived right across the street from him, but he was told that his father was really his uncle. So he that must have messed up his head a little bit, but yeah. So Bobby Deren's one of these guys. He doesn't know who his father is, and he's plagued with health problems from an early age. But he can clearly sing and play an instrument. Now, I have this theory that Bobby Deren's father is actually Frank Sinatra. That's my theory. Now, and I've looked at their charts, and they're kind of interesting together. So Bobby Deren's kicking around. He's just doing kind of, you know, kick around things. And he meets up with Don Kirshner on the East Coast. I think Don Kirshner like meets him at a candy store or something like that. The meeting of it's very strange. So he meets up with Don Kirshner, and then eventually he starts writing songs for the Brill Building, which if people aren't familiar with the Brill Building, it was this building in New York that housed writers, and primarily writers of popular songs and jingles. And that building might have been one of the most important buildings in, you know, Western modern Western pop culture, because you have a lot of people that are there at the Brill Building. Bobby Deren's there. Boyce and Hart, who would go on to write the Beatles, the Monkees tunes, are there. Carole King is there. Who else is there? Just a lot of Doc Pomus is there. Neil Diamond is there. So you have all these. Even Walter Becker and Donald Fagen have a brief run at the Brill Building. And what happens to all the Brill Building people is they all move west. They all go to California because that's where the recording industry winds up relocating. For a long time, the recording industry was in New York. And then rents are cheaper. There's more available land. And everything gets kind of centralized in LA. You have movies, you have recording, you have and TV. So there's like this executive decision, like this is where we're going. So you have all these people that move out there, and they continue to influence the American musical soundtrack in a really significant way. That's where the Monkees are born. And you have people like Glenn Campbell and Neil Diamond and Boyce and Hart. And, you know, and then so that's like the songwriting kind of arm of the Brill Building that gets relocated to LA. And then you have the musical side of things, and that's a group of musicians called the Wrecking Crew. And Tommy Telesco, and just so many people, Hal Wilner, all these really, really amazing, amazing studio musicians. So Bobby Deren winds up in that area. He winds up going to LA. And then there's this one character who is like the center of the kind of alternative, weird, even mainstream recording universe. He's like this hub with all these spokes that connect into him, and that's Terry Melcher. And Terry Melcher is the son of Doris Day. And Terry Melcher winds up connecting with both Carl Wilson and Dennis Wilson. Not so much with Brian, but mostly Carl and Dennis. And of course, Melcher is connected to Charlie Manson. So Bobby Deren is connected into Terry Melcher. And now we've got this 6 degree of separation between Bobby Deren and Terry Melcher. And then Bobby Deren's also connected to Bobby Kennedy. So Bobby Deren's this really unusual character and very talented. Like, real. I saw him one night on The Tonight Show, and he did this thing where he went from singing to piano playing and a couple of different genres. I mean, the guy was just super talented. So, so Bobby Darin was in that part of the world. And then there's also this weird thing. Again, it's this whole Gemini kind of theme. And there's another Darin. There's James Darin. Right? So you have Bobby Darin and James Darin. And Bobby Darin, I think, marries, who is it? Sandra Lee? Is that the woman who's in the movies with James Darin, who plays James Darin's girlfriend in those like Gidget movies or whatever? Well, Bobby Darin winds up marrying her. So there's this weird like connection, you know, with this Gemini like energy. You can even see it with Bobby Darin in a lot of ways. So anyway, there's that connection with Rosie Grier and then RFK. So he's there. He's in the restaurant where Sirhan, which is another Gemini kind of thing, right? Two names, Sirhan. By the way, I think Sirhan's up for parole. He might get paroled. And I don't think he shot him. I don't think he shot him at all.
Yeah. I mean, the LA police went in there and removed part of the ceiling where when Sirhan was in his robotic mind-controlled state, he was just, you know, pulling trigger and his rounds were going up to the ceiling while he was being held down. Meanwhile, you know, Bobby was getting shot by someone else. And then you've probably seen the archival footage of known CIA operatives in the lobby of the place. David Rodriguez, if memory serves. So the CIA was thick on the ground at the place.
Yep. So, yeah, and the whole Kennedy thing is pretty significant with 9/11 because it all starts with the Kennedy assassination on 11/22. And, you know, for the last 2 hours, I just went down that rabbit hole, and I started to really peel back the layers on this around 2011 when my interest in 9/11 got piqued again and started to do a lot of digging around the actual event itself. And then that later manifested in looking at these correspondences with 9/11 and taking me back to Kennedy. Because with Kennedy, everything shifts, right? There's a whole timeline shift with Kennedy. And some people don't think that Kennedy was killed. I personally do. I think he was killed. You could make a case that maybe he wasn't, because there's a whole kind of school of thought that everybody's faked their shit. And but even if he did fake himself, the effect of Kennedy's death is enough, right? It's enough because, number one, he's no longer president. Number two, Johnson's president. He rules out the Great Society. He rules out the war on poverty. Everything changes, entitlements, you know, everything. The socialist state just gets a shot of steroids at that point. And they're doing it in the wake of this trauma. And the Kennedy event is really the first major collective trauma of the 20th century, with one slight exception. There's another event that might rival it, but in a very different kind of way. So we have World War I. It's traumatic, but it rolls out like a slow tide, right? It's, you know, you have the ship that's got the Lusitania, right? The Lusitania is an issue, gets us into World War I, but it's not like the electronic village that we're living in. We have the Dust Bowl. It's a terrible event, but does it really affect people in New England? The answer to that is no, it really doesn't. We have the Depression, which is a pretty big event, and it's wide sweeping. But again, the Depression takes a long period of time. There's that initial shock, and then it just keeps rolling right up into, you know, Roosevelt and the New Deal, right? So to me, and I think there's a little bit of it with Pearl Harbor. There's some of it with Pearl Harbor. We start to get into some of that shock and awe with Pearl Harbor because it's just so shocking. But the event that really predates Pearl Harbor, which I think is the first collective traumatic event in the 20th century, is the broadcast of War of the Worlds. And because that connects everybody up at the same time with radio. And what's interesting is we're going to get into some of the Gemini stuff again, because the theater company, the radio theater company, is Mercury Theater, Mercury being the ruler of Gemini. And the person who is the head of the Mercury Theater is Orson Welles. And he's doing a radio version of the book by H.G. Wells. So now you have the two Wellses, right? So you have this Gemini thing happening. By the way, there's a really interesting, well, I wouldn't say it's necessarily interesting in terms of content, but it's interesting in terms of like the personalities. There's an interview that Orson Welles does with H.G. Wells. You can see it on YouTube. And I think it's the only time he interviewed him. And Orson Welles is like he's like a preening little Cub Scout. And H.G. Wells, of course, is this exalted kind of druidic mage that he's having this conversation with. But that event is the first real traumatic event. And I think some people might have even died from that event. And that was a Rockefeller-sponsored event, by the way. And Edward Bernays was kind of lurking in the wings. They wanted to see how people would react to a public event like that. So then you fast forward and you go to the Kennedy thing, and it's on TV. And then, of course, you have the thing with Ruby, which is weird. I do think the Ruby thing is staged, by the way, because they had to do like two takes on it. There's some weird stuff with the Ruby thing, the Ruby Oswald thing. I don't know what happens with Oswald ultimately, but it's almost like they had to replay it and do it twice. Have you seen those videos of the Ruby stuff?
I've only seen the iconic one when he rushes up to Oswald and, you know, puts his gun in his abdomen. I didn't know there was anything about takes and doing it twice.
Yes. So there's I think it's either a still or footage where there are things that are not in the real footage, right? Or the footage that we see. It's like, well, where did that come from? So there's this idea that was staged, and that could be because it'd have to be staged if there was something in one either film or still, and it's there and it's not in the other. So okay, there's that. And then of course Ruby, that's part of it too, though. Like that's part of the trauma. Like that's happening theoretically live on TV. And so this is this collective event that traumatizes everybody. And then, you know, they slip the programs in, and, you know, we have the 1960s. And so if you go back and you look at Kennedy, there's a lot of interesting symbolism around like the Fisher King and Arthur. You know, it's Arthurian, it's Camelot, and Jackie is Guinevere. And this is the new American century. And Kennedy is this king like character, and he's going to usher it all in.
And was Catholic president too.
Catholic. That's first overt Catholic president. And then this thing happens, right? And it's really a lot like the Fisher King and you know, Pound's Wasteland. Because after the death of Kennedy, we can begin to see the decay creep into the American story. And we were moving, you know, deeper and deeper into, you know, if we're looking at like these ideas of the turning, we're going from the spring of America and the first turning and the heroism of, you know, theoretically World War II, Audie Murphy and all that stuff. Audie Murphy's a weird guy too, by the way. Well, if we want, we could talk about Audie Murphy a little bit. I don't want to get too far off the track, but it's Audie Murphy, John Wayne, Iwo Jima, all those movies, right? Go America. We're moving into the second turning, which is the summer, right? So the first turning is associated with spring. And this is the birth of, you know, industrialism and all the stuff that we think about with America after the war, suburbs, growth. And then we move into this summer period, the second turning, which is really like the summer of discontent. So that turning is associated with like, it's the time of the artist. And so in the springtime, we have the hero. And then in the summer, we have the anti-hero. And you and I were talking about Clint Eastwood. And John Wayne hated Clint Eastwood. He hated him. I think Clint Eastwood wanted him to be in one of his movies, and John Wayne wouldn't do it. because he made being a cowboy, you know, violent and dangerous. And so this is really symbolic of these two figures. What's interesting too, is that John Wayne and Clint Eastwood are both Geminis. So you can see again, this whole Gemini thing and, you know, Wayne reflecting back to one time and Eastwood, you know, projecting into the next time. So we see this with the 60s. It's the birth of the anti-hero. And he's not the only one. There's Steve McQueen and all these characters, right? And that's very much part of the 60s. And so this, but this program gets kind of inserted in the 60s. You know, we have MK Ultra, we have Tavistock, we have the Beatles. The Beatles play a really large role in the cultivation of the counterculture, for better or worse. And what's interesting is that the Beatles' second album called Meet the Beatles, and it's the album cover where half of their faces are in shade and half of their faces are illuminated. It's introduced in France and England and Canada on the day John Kennedy's killed on 11/22. It's really weird. It's like you would think that they would release it in America. Why wouldn't they release it in America at the same time? You're just going to go for it, right? I mean, but they don't. So is it because Kennedy was killed? Or was it because somehow they might have known that Kennedy was going to get killed? I don't know the answer to that. But what I do know is that, technically speaking, that album hits Terra Firma in North America on 11/22. So now we have Meet the Beatles, Say Goodbye to Kennedy happening simultaneously. Now that's on 11/22. The Beatles would release another album on 11/22/1968, and that would be the White Album. And that's happening a few months after the death of RFK, which I think is what, July 27th? Is that when it happened? So just a few months after RFK is assassinated, the Beatles have another album. And it's not just any album. It's the album with Helter Skelter, Revolution 1, Revolution 9. It's a double album set, which is kind of revolutionary in and of itself. And that's where, of course, we start to pick up on the Manson story, the Terry Melcher story, the Topanga Canyon story. You know, the whole Dave McGowan tale, the military industrial complex, settling in and around that area, creating the scene of the 1960s, which they did overnight. I mean, it happens overnight. Hollywood and Vine was nothing but really kind of sleazy strip clubs. And then overnight, they're playing, you know, their venues. The Whiskey A Go-Go starts playing rock and roll. The Birds show up. The Freaks coming down from Topanga Canyon begin to go into the clubs and start doing their freaky dancing. Vitas Kowakis, the really creepy guy that's living in the big house in Topanga Canyon that Tom Mix used to have, his whole scene, which is connected to Kenneth Anger, which is the whole Lucifer Rising process church scene. They're part of it, right?
I think Jimmy Page helped with the soundtrack of that.
Yeah, he got into a beef with Kenneth Anger around that. And some people think that part of what happened with Led Zeppelin was a result of Kenneth Anger, you know, doing some kind of ritual on Jimmy Page and the rest of it, because some tragic shit happens to Led Zeppelin.
Yes.
Pretty big way. But this Vitas Kowakis guy, I think that's his name, he's really a trip, right? So he's the one that's kind of running the scene with all these freaks. They call them freaks. And they have names like, Super Poppy, Sunshine Marmalade, you know, stupid, weird names. And they were hired to go down to places like the Whiskey A Go-Go and dance all these freaky dances. And the band at that time that was also there, besides the Birds, I think the first band to show up. And then it's Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And then Frank Zappa goes in and takes over that house from this Vitas guy. And this Vitas guy is a kid, a baby, young kid. He's around 4 or 5 years old. He's actually supposed to be in Lucifer Rising. The baby is supposed to be in the movie Lucifer Rising. But something happens to the kid The kid gets killed somehow. Something weird happens to him. So he's not in the movie. And then Bobby Beausoleil, who's from the Manson family, winds up playing Lucifer in the movie Lucifer Rising. So then this Vetus character winds up going to Jamaica. He has to leave the country because it's getting too hot and too weird. But you go down the Dave McGowan rabbit hole, and it's just military industrial complex, military. And a lot of them are coming from Washington, D.C. in the Virginia era. Frank Zappa comes from the Washington, D.C. area. His father actually works for a munitions company, right? He's doing work on missiles, and he's doing payload work on missiles. Gail Slopeman, who's his wife, eventual wife, comes from that area. She went to kindergarten with Jim Morrison in Washington, D.C. Jim Morrison, of course, from Washington, D.C., shows up in the L.A. area. There are all these connections there. John Phillips has this weird connection with being like a soldier of fortune and, you know, actually working for the CIA. You know, there's stories about John Phillips being in the Bay of Pigs. Stephen Stills would get high in L.A., and he would talk about when he was in Vietnam. And people go, what, Stephen, you're freaking crazy. But he probably was in Vietnam. He was probably part of the group that was there, right, for the CIA, you know, being observers or whatever, prior to the United States going into Vietnam. He would get high and talk about it. So there are all these strange connections with all these people. And then he would link into, like, David Crosby being a member of the Van Dyne family and, you know, all this money that's associated with them. And also, what's his name? The guy that who's really Graham Parsons is another guy that shows up in there, comes from a very wealthy family. Jackson Brown comes from New York, and he comes out of the Warhol scene from New York. And he shows up there. He comes there a little bit later. He's part of the Avocado Mafia. But that whole thing happens in LA during that time. And that's all right on the heels of the Kennedy assassination. The counterculture, it's like it's overnight. You know, there's this major reset that happens overnight. And the advertising changes. They're going after the youth in a big way. Madison Avenue knows there are all these baby boomers. They want to get into their heads. They want to get into their pocketbooks. They want to start fads. That's a big thing. So that all happens on the heels of Kennedy. So you have the music changing. You have the cinema changing. Even TV changes. TV changes a bit later on. TV changes in 1968. So it takes about 5 years for TV to change. In TV, they have this thing called the Great Purge. And there are shows like Beverly Hillbillies, Green Acres, Petticoat Junction. They're all doing really well. The ratings on these shows were doing really, really well. There was no reason to cancel these shows. There were Westerns like Gunsmoke. Yeah. Bonanza, the Wild Wild West, Falls
Rifleman.
They all get canceled. And the guy that's behind it is this guy named Brandon Tartikoff, who's a TV executive and producer. And so it's like, we're done. It's the Great Purge, and we're going to give America a different kind of programming. This is when Laugh-In shows up.
Of the variety shows.
Variety shows come in. They were already kind of there, but they're like, there's a lot of variety shows. Like Red Skelton had a variety show during that time. Red Skelton, by the way, a master mason. So the Great Purge is when socially conscious programming also comes into play. You have shows like Bridget Loves Bernie, which is the first show where you have a shiksa marrying a nice Jewish boy. So Meredith Baxter, who is actually the wife of David Burney, who plays her husband both on and off the screen. So you have Bridget Loves Bernie, Room 222, where you have a very integrated and diverse high school, Lloyd Haynes, right? Denise Nichols.
So The Graduate came out around that time, 68, right? Hoffman.
Yeah, it comes out around 68. The show that is really the pivotal show for everything during that time, which sort of predates the Great Purge, is I Spy. And so you have, again, it's a Gemini thing, because Gemini, you're dealing with people who have different identities, right? So you have Robert Culp, and you have Bill Cosby, who are tennis pros, but they're really spies posing as tennis pros. And then you have the black and white thing, which is very Gemini. And I think it's Sheldon, what's his name, is the creator of it. The same guy that did Get Smart. I forget his last name, but I went back and I watched some of those I Spies. They're not very good. They're kind of in this weird kind of cross between comedy and kind of the spy thing. Like, I think they got it better with Get Smart, which was a Mel Brooks production. But that's a really pivotal show, that whole I Spy thing. It's the first time, you know, a leading character who is black shares the same bill with a male character. And then right after that, you have that show. I think it's called Diane, with Diane Carroll. And I think it's the first show with a leading black female character. And you, being a football guy, would be into this. Fred Williamson plays her love interest on that show.
The Hammer. Yep.
The Hammer. Right. The Hammer. So it's a big time. So it's the Purge. I call it the Great Purge. And that's part of,
you know what? I think Fred the Hammer Williamson had the first overt. No. Jim Brown had the first.
Jim Brown with Raquel Welch. With
Raquel Welch
in 100 Rifles.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he didn't want to do it, by the way. Jim Brown didn't want to do that scene. He didn't want to be. I think Jim Brown knew he was kind of being exploited.
Yes, definitely.
He didn't want to do that scene.
He left the NFL because he felt he was being exploited. And
I like Jim Brown.
Yeah, I do too. I do too.
He's somebody that I wish I could have had a real conversation with when he still had all of his faculties, because he's not all there right now. But he had interesting things to say about Michael Jordan too, which we don't have to get into. But,
you know, while the thought is still fresh in my mind, another shock and awe death, which kind of gets overlooked, was the mysterious death of Bruce Lee, right? And I was a Bruce Lee fanatic back in the day. Yep. As a matter of fact, I'm reading a biography about him, and his death came as quite a shock for many of us back then. And his absolutely. Career got jump-started in L.A. He used to have a kung fu studio in Oakland, and mm-hmm. then he went down to L.A. and got his career going there.
Yeah, Bruce Lee's a fascinating character. And I was into martial arts at the time. So I was, you know, doing Taekwondo and stuff. And, you know, if you were a kid in the '70s, you were doing karate pretty much. And, that was really, really shocking. So again, for playing with this Gemini theme, he's got a really interesting kind of Gemini narrative with Jimi Hendrix.
Yes. Yes. And then his own son dies during the making of The Crow, which was was a show that was steeped in esoterica and occultism.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. So Jimi Hendrix and Bruce Lee are born on the same day. Different years, but the same day. They're both Sagittarius. They both have connections with Seattle, Washington. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, they're both mixed. Jimi Hendrix's mother is Japanese. And I think, I'm pretty sure that Bruce Lee's mother might be English. I could be mistaken there. But they both are in Seattle. They're born on the same day. And they both have this profound impact on culture. They set new kind of standards for the thing that they're doing. So they're very interesting in terms of their kind of Gemini story. They're Sagittarians though. So what's interesting about Bruce Lee is that he's in Hong Kong, and he's like a child star in Hong Kong. He does, like, you know.
Yes, right? He was a well-known child actor. That's where his father was, in a traveling troupe. And that's right. It was in the family, basically.
Right. So he has to leave Hong Kong because he got into some trouble in Hong Kong. And so he comes to the States. And he becomes really popular in the States. This is where he finds his fame. And for Jimi Hendrix, he's born in the States, but then he goes to England. And that's where he experiences his popularity and rise to fame, which is a very Sagittarian thing in dealing with other countries. So, yeah, I mean, Bruce Lee was, you know, blew everybody's mind when that happened. It was like, and they kept trying to figure out, well, you know, is there another Bruce Lee? Can we bring another Bruce Lee into the fold? And they had all these kind of weird Bruce Lee, you know, kind of doubles and stuff. And it's just like, you know, don't go there. It's also interesting that the guy that really winds up taking Bruce Lee's mantle is Chuck Norris, who I've never had a whole lot of interest in. I've never really liked Chuck Norris.
Another was Jackie Chan, who was one of the extras in some of the Bruce Lee films that were made in Hong Kong.
Jackie Chan, I think, is really more the heir to Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. And the thing about Jackie Chan that's amazing is that he's really, really funny. He's super funny. He's like Buster Keaton meets Bruce Lee. He's a very physical comedian. I really like Jackie Chan. I love his movies. They're just great to watch. He's an amazing martial artist too. So yeah, man, that was a heavy one. That was a heavy blow. But they're inserting all these programs during the 60s, and the Great Purge is TV's part of it. So yeah, that happens on the heels of Kennedy, and of course 1122 is 33. Which is a pretty significant number in terms of Freemasonry. You get to that 33rd degree, you're initiated, right? And you're a made man at the 33rd degree in Freemasonry. So that's part of it as well. And then we have George Bush, who theoretically is on the ground in Dallas at that time, as part of the CIA. And then even the city Dallas is very esoteric. You look at the name Dallas, you just see those two L's right in the center, you know, like two towers, you know, and then you have the star, you know, the Dallas star, the five pointed star, the number of man. And then Dealey, who Dealey Plaza is named after, was a publisher of, I think it is the Dallas Star, the newspaper there, who was a Mason. And he's the guy that basically, kickstarts what's his name? Cyrus Schofield, right? The Schofield Bible, which is the Bible that they use to tell the rapture story. He's the guy that gets it going. Schofield is he's an alcoholic. He's a philanderer. He goes into some kind of recovery program, winds up going to Dallas to begin this new version of the Bible, the Schofield Bible. And eventually somebody else writes the majority of that Bible. It's not him, but it starts off as a Freemasonic project because Dealey's funding this thing. So if you go to Dallas, it's got a weird vibe. Like you go from Fort Worth or Arlington into Dallas, you'll see these twin columns. You'll see like Boaz and Yakin, you know, over these bridges and stuff. They're all over the place there. So we have the whole Dallas thing. We have the George Bush thing. George Bush, by the way, is a Gemini. Factor that in. And then we get thrown off into this timeline, this very different alternative timeline. And what's interesting is that, Alan Moore kind of explores this a little bit, in The Watchmen, and that he talks about a different timeline where Nixon uses the atom bomb on Vietnam to end the war. And then you've got this whole story about, that's a very interesting movie, by the way, The Watchmen. At first I didn't like it, and then I watched it again and I liked it more. And then I saw parts of it a third time and I thought, this is a really interesting movie. There's some sub narratives there that I think are really fascinating. So, but if we looked at Kennedy and saw where we were and what was going on, had Kennedy managed to live through that, we'd be living in a very different world, really different world. There's a really good chance that we'd have been out of Vietnam. We wouldn't have had Vietnam. There's a really good chance that Nixon may not have become president. And I'm not anti-Nixon, by the way, but there's a good chance he wouldn't have become president. Kennedy could have been elected easily to a second term. There is no doubt about that. There was a rumor that he was working with the Hunt brothers and John Connolly in the state of Texas, and that they were going to essentially run the silver market and create a new silver-backed dollar. And it would be something, you know, because Kennedy basically takes silver away, right? That's a big part of this whole thing. But there was a reason why. And the reason why is that they were going to do something new, do something different. And it was going to get it out of the hands of the Federal Reserve. And they were going to run everything out of Texas, which is one of the reasons why theoretically it was here in Texas. And the Hunt brothers were involved. Of course, John Connolly's in the front seat of that that limo. So again, I mean, you're doing a runaround with the Federal Reserve, getting us out of fiat banking, keeping us out of the Vietnam War. The other thing that was going on during that time is that he was having an affair with Mary Pinchot Meyer, who was the wife of Cord Meyer, who was the head of the CIA at that time. And the rumor was that Mary Meyer and a group of these other women she was associated with were actually friends with Timothy Leary. And they were getting LSD from Timothy Leary.
And just a key quick point, Cord Meyer played a key role in promoting all these progressive movements back in the day.
Yep. So there's this theory that Mary Meyer was dosing JFK, and that JFK was having this complete shift in consciousness. So after JFK dies, it's not long after JFK dies, Mary Meyer's dead. Of course, Marilyn Monroe dies, right? Not long after. Marilyn Monroe is also a Gemini, by the way. So there's this, in my opinion, we were headed down a different track. And a track where, the other thing too is like, there's this huge convergence of Aquarius in 1962. I think it's like seven planets in 1962. It's often called the Antichrist chart, by the way, this one chart, 1962. And it's kind of the birth of the Aquarian age in a lot of ways. And that happens during Kennedy's time. So in 63, I mean, theoretically, that's the vector, right? We're headed towards this Aquarian vector. And Kennedy, who is this Fisher King character, this Christ-like character, who's also very much connected to the Piscean age, is leading, theoretically, America into the new age or the Aquarian age. We're talking about space exploration and the moon and all that stuff. And then he's taken out. So we would have gone down a very different path. And instead, you know, we get introduced into really the first iteration, big. I mean, it happens during Roosevelt, but this is really big in the 60s. You know, the socialism and the Communist Party really get their claws into the United States after Kennedy through Johnson, who's a piece of shit. NPR comes out of that period of time, which is really just propaganda. Cloward Piven come out of that. All the social programs come out of that. We begin to see the decimation of the Black family.
The Immigration Act.
Immigration Act with Johnson.
That just set the clock ticking right there.
And so we go deeper into Vietnam, and who are they getting? They're not getting the George Bushes and the Donald Trumps of the world. You know, they're getting the Leroy Jenkinses of the world. And, you know, they're sending them off to Vietnam. They're getting the young guys from Rust Belt America. You know, they're getting the young guys from the inner cities. They're getting the young guys from the South. And they're sending them off, you know, sheep to slaughter. And a lot of them happen to be Black. And there's not, you could get a college deferment. If you had the right people in your corner, you'd get a college deferment. Who's not going to college? You know, lower class, working class, and people that are part of different ethnic minority groups generally are not going to college.
Getting the college deferments? These poison ivy Yale-y types, these effete kind of socialist-minded individuals are the ones that are, you know, getting off the hook, basically.
Right. Trump gets off the hook. George Bush flies for what, the Texas National Guard or Air Guard, whatever. By the way, his father was supposedly a terrible pilot. And George Bush, when he was in the military, would tell people he was going to be president of the United States. He knew he was going to be president, by the way.
Well, to you know, interject for a second, even the circumstances of George Bush Sr.'s airstrike mission, there is some thought that he abandoned his two crewmen rather than trying to fly the you know, the plane back to the aircraft carrier. He just said, F you guys, right?
Right.
So,
Yeah. So we have this thing that happens during the 60s. It's terror. It's all the social programs. Huge social programs. And I can't stress this enough. This is where Black America just gets a kick in the nuts, man. Because while the men are away, you know, in the Vietnam War, either being killed, shell-shocked, or turned into junkies or drug dealers, not all of them, by the way, but this is a big thing that happens. Their women are here at home, and who's knocking on their door but Saul Alinsky and the community organizer, and say, we got this welfare thing for you. Well, I don't really want it. No, you need to have it. So now all of a sudden, you know, the plantation state comes in, and we have all the social programs that kick in during this period while the men are away. It's a brutal time, right? It's a really brutal time. If you look at I did this when I was on Gaia, you look at the rates of Black families prior to like 1970 and after 1970, it's a big gap. It's a really big gap. And all this happens with Johnson. So
the disproportionate number of Black families were two-parent families back then.
That's exactly
it's completely bass backwards opposite now.
Absolutely. And again, it's a byproduct of what happens after Kennedy dies. So we're thrust into this alternative timeline. And America, instead of really, you know, having this vertical lift, right? America begins to experience demoralization. You have Nixon, you have Watergate. Vietnam goes on forever. It's like, when is this fucking war going to end?
Yeah, and the eerie parallels about what happened recently in Afghanistan, which was entirely predictable in many ways. And just interject quickly.
Yep.
When you talk about how radicalization really went through the roof in the Vietnam era, Kennedy is bumped off. Johnson is installed. Gulf of Tonkin. And then what they did was suddenly the campuses with all these lefty professors and all these lefty students were radicalized. You had riots, the Weathermen, the animus directed towards the returning soldiers, and the riots and in Detroit and Watts and everywhere else. Things just went haywire.
Oh, brutal. 1968 is a brutal year. Brutal year. And
things are at a convention. The only time they ever went after the Democrats, well, really, it was a coordinated, you know, communist subversive activity.
Oh, and the Weather Underground got their asses kicked. They, you know, it was their days of rage, and they ran into Daley, not Dealey. They ran into Daley, and Daley was like, just get them. Beat the hell out of them. And they did, you know, the Chicago cops beat them up with rubber bullets and baseball bats, and they took a beating. Serious beating. Yeah, I mean, this is what happens during the 60s. It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. And there's this radicalization. What's interesting about the Weather Underground is that the group that was really the voice, the anti-war movement voice, was Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. And there was a convention. They had a convention. SDS was there. And by the time the convention starts and when the convention ends, the Weather Underground has taken over. They have supplanted SDS. They're running the show. They're running the anti-war movement. Bernadine Dorn, Bill Ayers, Mark Rudd, they're all running the show at that point. And they're all connected to elites. They're all, you know, I'm pretty convinced that the Weather Underground was an intelligence operation. But it was a bifurcated one because the FBI had infiltrated the Weather Underground. So I don't know if it was the CIA who was creating the Weather Underground, or I'm not sure what arm, but yeah, Larry Grathwald involved in the being there with, and they hassled the Weather Underground. The Weather Underground was always on the move, and eventually the FBI split them up and they had to come up from being underground. But yeah, that happens, right? And so eventually, as a result of all of this, I've talked about this, you know, you get Barack Obama and Bill Ayers, and they show up in a post 9/11 world in 2016. And that probably doesn't happen if Kennedy is still alive, and because this historical vector of events takes place.
And yeah, you have Nixon take over. Who was he running against? Adlai Stevenson, when he eventually became president? Because I know so
Nixon had two elections. The first election, he went up against Hubert Humphrey, who was kind of closer to what we would think a Democrat used to be. You know, he was pro-labor, pro-family, working class family. He was anti-war, not a very charismatic candidate. And then in the second election, which was in 1972, he was against George McGovern.
McGovern, that's it. Adlai Stevenson was a UN secretary guy.
That's right. And the whole Nixon thing is again, part of the ritual. Nixon is the killing of the father. Nixon is a Capricorn. Capricorn represents paternal figures. So this whole idea of these kids, you know, that are born during the baby boom generation, they're living out this Oedipal mythology, and they want to kill their father. And even if you listen to The End by Jim Morrison, that's what he talks about. And he talks about Oedipus. Mom, Dad, I want to kill you, right? This is the narrative of the young men of the 1960s. And their baby boomers are born with Pluto and Leo. Leo's a sun sign. It also represents the father. The sun and Saturn are both the father in the chart. The sun is when you're younger, your father's playful and plays around with you and you have fun, right? Roll around and wrestle. But as you get older, he becomes Saturn and he lays down the rules and etiquette and discipline. So you have these two dueling versions. So the 60 generation wants to take their place in the seat of power, right? They want to go from being the sun to Saturn in their own life. They only want to take on the man. So Nixon's the man. They're gonna kill Nixon, which is what they do ultimately. It's a ritual sacrifice.
It was a bloodless coup, is what it was. And the subtext to that is, with Nixon comes Kissinger, and then Nixon is outed with Watergate. So Gerald Ford is a presumed president. He had Nelson Rockefeller as his vice president for a while. And then Kissinger, who was a Nelson Rockefeller protege, first national security advisor, then secretary of state. And then you have that in the late 60s, early 70s, that secret ping pong diplomacy, which aligned U.S. Anglo-Zionist interests more closely with the Chinese. So we begin to see that framework start to develop. And now you fast forward to today, you know, who's basically running the show in Afghanistan now? Well, it's the Chinese. Now they've got like open, unfettered access across Afghanistan to Pakistan, to that port, that huge port they created in Gwadar, I think it is. So it all just ties in together, Robert. This is just something that they planned segment by segment over time. And definitely, you know, the 9/11 thing. And there's a school of thought that says, on the one hand, oh, 9/11 happened 20 years ago, why is it still relevant? Well, that's not even any point debating that issue. But still, you know, the mental rigid mindset of so many military and ex-military people who still think that they fought a just war, who still think that they were fighting against Al-Qaeda after all this time. You listen to their podcast. I sometimes do. These older military people now, you know, reliving their past glories, just like they just can't let go of that paradigm. And that's a big part of why everything is so screwed up, is the people who could be making a difference are still stuck in this paradigm where they thought that they were, you know, avenging America for what happened on 9/11.
Right. That's a really interesting point. Are we going to break soon? Do you want to stop here?
Let's take a short break right now. And Robert, go ahead and give the audience your website and YouTube information.
Yeah, robertphoenix.com. That's my website. 15 Minutes of Flame. That's 15 Minutes OV of Flame. It's another website that I stream from. That's also the name of a YouTube channel I have, which recently I reinstated. Don't ask me why. And then I have the 11th House also on YouTube. And there's two versions of that because one got shut down. I started a new one and then they reinstituted the old one. So you can find me in those places. And Astro9Phoenix on Twitter.
And for those of you who enjoy our content here with the Cosmic Switchboard Show, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com and sign up, become a member. We're just getting started. This is tip of the iceberg stuff. We're going to go into a deep dive in the second segment. So we'll be back shortly.